Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
As a woman squarely in midlife, I am wanting to be much more intentional about the way I live, eat, and take care of my body. I'm always looking for an on-the-go protein snack that satisfies me, and now I've found one that also helps me live intentionally. Mosh Bars. Mosh, which you may have heard about on Shark Tank, was founded by Maria Shriver and her son Patrick Schwarzenegger with a simple mission: to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. Mosh has joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to go beyond your average protein bar. With 8 delicious flavors, including a plant-based one in peanut butter and chocolate, each Mosh bar is made with ingredients that support brain health, like ashwagandha, lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. And now Mosh bars come with a new look and new formulation, featuring a game-changing, brain-boosting ingredient that you won't find in any other bar. Mosh is now the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. But here's the best part. It also makes you feel good, because Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Why gender-based? 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women, and Mosh is working to close the gap between women and men's health research. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PSTP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack at moshlife.com/PSTP. Thanks, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, this is Duran. And we're going to pause here. The people on this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to cover this last wild week. Lord, there's a lot going on. And, you know, this episode, we didn't always see eye to eye. So I'm excited for you to hear us talk about the news. Then I sat down with the acclaimed scholar and the chair of the ACLU National Board, the one and only Deborah Archer, to talk about her new book, Dividing Lines: How Transportation Infrastructure Reinforces Racial Inequality. I learned a ton. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People to stay updated with all things Pod Save the People. Here we go. Well, it seems like every week gets a little wilder than the last week, and here we are at war. We are back. This is Dre at DRAY on Twitter.
This is Miles at Pharaoh Rapture on Instagram and Moon Pulpit on Twitter.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn at BossierS on Spill, and once again at BossierShay on Instagram. And shout out to Miles for bullying me into getting back on Instagram.
Bullying works.
Also, make sure that you are following me, actually, not the imposter account. Somebody's been impersonating me on Instagram. They have like 6,200 followers and have been doing it for almost 3 years, it seems, which I just found out this week. So
I'm sorry, Sharonda. I needed the money.
Y'all are funny. Oh, Sharonda, I'm going to reach out to somebody on Instagram and try and get that taken down. I didn't know they had like real followers pretending to be you.
Yes, yes, yes. And I've tried to report it, and Instagram has been like, this account doesn't violate our community standards. So I would appreciate the help. If any of you listening work at Instagram, help the girl out.
Okay.
That's rough. Well, you know, the only real news to talk about before we talk about our individual news is that Trump has taken us into war with Iran. It happened very quickly. We all saw it play out online because he posted it on Truth Social last night. And I just wanted to get your takes on what do you think is happening? What's going on? Yeah, where are you with Iran?
I'm traveling right now, so I want to just I'm learning about this with all of you all. And literally when Sharonda put the news in was the first time that I heard of it, just because I just have been so unplugged. Of course, my first response is, I hope that nobody tries to attempt to make this seem like something that was going to happen exclusively by Trump. I think we've done a lot of things so far that are special and unique and only Trump would do. There has been no Democratic leadership that has or no leadership in general across parties that have shown a different destiny. And this is the destiny that everybody said was going to happen, period, because that's what America is going to do. And that's the relationship we have with Israel. And that has been Netanyahu's plan. So I hope that people take this as a moment to be anti-war, to really review what has happened and say, how did we get here, and not try to play partisan politics, because there was no leadership that expressed any type of loyalty to peace. And I hope that that is not misconstrued, because Trump happens to be the person to press that button, because it looked like every piece of leadership we had was going to press that button when Netanyahu decided to do it.
Yeah, I also am traveling. I'm on a girls' trip in Santa Fe and was in Meow Wolf, which is like an immersive art experience. And as we were like pulling out our phones to like, you know, try and figure out the next part of this puzzle, like all of the news alerts came through, right? And I was like, you know what? We're trying to figure out where this family went, as they have been experimenting with dimensional travel. I want to be in whatever dimension they are in that is not this one. and I think part of my reaction was, I think to Miles's point, this has seemed, unfortunately, for all intents and purposes, almost an inevitability, regardless of who was in power, because I think we sort of knew this is what Netanyahu wanted to do, and we knew that the way that the U.S. has chosen to show up as an ally to Israel was likely going to draw us into this broader war. I think what has been interesting is, like, you know, on the right, Republicans who are like, we, you know, this man campaigned on not dragging us into another forever war. And this very clearly is going to be another forever war if and when Iran retaliates. I think it's also been interesting to hear Democrats say things like, Congress is the only, you know, body that has the ability to declare war. This is unconstitutional, et cetera, et cetera. And that seems a little bit ahistorical, because for a long time, U.S. presidents have authorized these kinds of airstrikes and other military actions unilaterally, right, including Democratic presidents. And then I think lastly, you know, hearing the response from other countries in the region and saying, like, y'all, we need to de-escalate this. We need to de-escalate this. We need to de-escalate this. And, you know, knowing that some of the folks who want to have an opportunity and a rationale and a justification to attack U.S., military operations, bases, interests, et cetera, in the region are likely going to leverage this. I think it's just a really scary time. And I think we're just seeing like a dialing up of just so much, violence is, if violence feels like too puny a word to describe what's happening. But I think it's really terrifying. And I think what I am observing is, you know, Trump got out-Trumped by Netanyahu in this moment. And still, I don't know if anyone else had been in power, the U.S. would have made a different decision. So I'm wrestling with that right now on Sunday morning.
I didn't anticipate us to be at odds on this one, but I disagree with both of you pretty strongly, actually. I think that this idea that, like, both sides are the same is dangerous rhetoric. I think that that only inflames the political sphere. And I think that it is not true. I think that, you know, Obama entered the Iran nuclear agreement specifically to avoid this. Trump's cover for this is actually about nuclear weapons, which Biden also continued the Iran nuclear deal. Kamala was clear that she would also continue the Iran nuclear deal. Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, which is sort of how we got into this mess here. Now, that is not to say that any of them were critical of Israel, because, like, they were not. And that is just, and Israel has nuclear weapons, which the United States is pretending to ignore. Right. And if the world acknowledged Israel's nuclear weapons, then we would not be able to send Israel aid. So everybody participated in that. And that is unreal. You're like, what does Israel have on everybody? You're like, who are they blackmailing me? Like, what is going on? Yeah. So I do think that is true across the parties, but you know, and to this idea that Democratic presidents have unilaterally entered war, not in our lifetime. I think the Iraq War is a great example, is that, you know, there was vigorous debate about the Iraq War that was in response to, or like the idea was that it was in response to a terrorist attack, which was a lie. But still, Congress, and famously Barbara Lee, right, was the lone person in Congress who decided to vote against it. But the idea that in the absence of an attack on Americans, that the president just like launches missiles into another country is new. So I worry about this idea that both sides are the same. I think that's not true. I think that I cannot imagine Kamala would have done this preemptively. And I cannot imagine that the landscape that we're in would have just glossed over it. Like Trump is like, Trump's not even giving a briefing till Tuesday. That would not have happened under any other presidency. So I'll be interested to see how this plays out. I'll be interested to see what Obama says, or Clinton, or Hillary, or the other people who were leading. But the idea that American troops will die soon because of this, which had nothing to do with America, frankly, besides this Netanyahu running game on America.
Yeah, but Duray, how then does like Obama's authorizing of drone strikes in other countries, right, where he was killing foreign nationals, and I think in one instance authorized the killing of a U.S. citizen, right? Like, how does that square with this, right? I think my point was that like presidents have sidestepped Congress even in not authorizing war, in authorizing military action, and in authorizing the use of military force. And so this does not seem like too far a departure from that. Is probably a better articulation of my point.
That's fair. I need to learn more. Like, national security is not my, I don't know about the drone strike. I mean, I remember it happening, but I don't know the details. I just think that is materially different than using the cover of nuclear weapons and bombing a nuclear stronghold under that pretense when there was a deal in place to avoid this. Like, we had two presidencies that explicitly tried to undo this, or like tried to avoid this specific moment. And Trump not only backs out of the agreement, and here we are, right? And even Trump's own advisors, who are shady people, they were even like, I don't know if Iran actually has been working on nuclear weapons, right? Because of the deal that was brokered for the past administration. So it just feels different to me. And I really cannot imagine Kamala or Biden or Obama doing this in this way. I think this is apples and oranges. I do not think that they are the same in this way.
I think that has probably more to do with, I think, the changing nature of war than anything, right? I think that has more to do with the changing nature of war than it has to do with people's actual values and positionality around which body has the authority to make what calls. But I hear you.
I do agree that if anybody else was in the presidency, it would have happened differently. That is the whole thing I've been complaining about. It is, it will have been a polite entrance into war. But so my thing is like, yeah, it is apples and oranges. My thing is all the fruit is rotten. So I'm saying no matter how we got there, we would have ended up in a place similar to this, even if it went through certain types of bureaucracies. But what I wanted to, what I was thinking about that kind of is about this, but a little bit separate, was there was so much conversation on the internet and between my friends and different social circles that I was in that really believed that the things that were happening in Palestine, that the things that were happening in the Middle East had nothing to do with what was happening to Black people, Black Americans. And we know that Black Americans and poor Black folks overrepresent in the military. So that's how come we have to care about Palestine. That's why we have to have leaders who are able to say what is right, what's wrong, even if they want to win something. That's why we need those type of forces, because now that we are in this moment that we're either going to tiptoe and ballet into slowly over years, or do it instantly and with brute force like Trump is doing, we were going to end up here, and no matter what, it was going to be poor Black people's blood who was going to pay for this war. And that's how come, here I'm saying it, I'm saying it for the living room. That's why I want any Black person hearing my voice to think about divesting from anything to do with this government. government, because specifically when it comes to this military, because it is going to be your body, your life that's going to be put on the line, and they do not care. You are just another chess piece, and this is proof of it. And not that I'm glad, of course, that we are in any type of war, but I'm glad that it's happening in a way that I see people being illuminated by, oh, this feels just like Iraq. Because, of course, Obama didn't start Iraq or the war in Iraq, but he sustained it. There are so many people who sustained the violence and kept it going and performed one thing and let us stay there for a long time. And last thing I'll say about this that has to do with this war, but really about the Trump era in general, it will be interesting to see what policies that the Democrats or liberals, when gain control, will allow to sustain. Because that is oftentimes the game plan. Trump does it, and then it gets sustained, and you give us some bullshit about, well, it takes 20 years. No, it doesn't.
Remember, Obama is who withdrew us from Iraq. To suggest that anything that he did not, I think, is just not true framing. He is who took us out of Iraq. I think that, again, Obama negotiated. And I hate that I'm the Obama defender of this one, but Obama negotiated the Iran nuclear deal. I don't know what to say. And I do think it is sort of like, I don't know who gets served well by this idea that everybody would have been like Donald Trump eventually. I think that is just not true.
I think Black people having their own sovereign ideas around politics that are not attached to electoral politics is who wins. I think the more Black people who engage with electoral politics and engage with global politics, not from a framework of nationalism or imperialism, but the framework from what's best for me and my community and not how I can give my body to some white man in power or some white or some Black woman who's serving a white power ideal in power, I think that's who wins. As long as we are thinking what is good for Black people first and not what's good for this disastrous project, I think that's who could win.
I agree with that. But I want us all to be careful about this idea that, like, everything would have been like Donald in the end. I think that's just not true framing. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start investing for your retirement, because the sooner you start, the more of a chance your money has to grow. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified RA portfolio that can help you weather all the market's ups and downs. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you get started with the money you've got right now. You'd be surprised at what just $5 a day could do. Plus, sign up for Acorns Gold and you'll get a 3% IRA match on new contributions in your first year. That's extra money for your retirement on Acorns. Now, I had no clue about any of this stuff, how to set myself up for retirement. Like, I didn't know anything. Acorns is a great place for me to learn how to do something with my money. I'm telling you, great place to start. Sign up now and join over 1 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $2.2 billion for their retirement with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/PSDP or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/PSDP.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
One of my news is immigration, which we probably will disagree about this too. Let me start by saying, you know, I've seen, and I can't even remember his name, but one of Obama's advisors, oh, Axelrod, who I know, and I was a fellow at the Institute on Politics that Axelrod ran, and I like him generally. And I saw his tweet where he was like, we deported more people than Trump. And you're like, well, what a bad... This is why people hate the party. Now, I'm with you on my... I'm like, well, no, this is rough. But I want to talk about immigration because one of the things that I keep seeing is both that sentiment and just from a numbers perspective, I'm like reminded that it's not like Trump's ICE round one was like a better ICE than ICE has normally been. What Trump had that no other president had in American history was COVID. So a lot of things changed during... Like there are some things around Trump's numbers that just looked better because nobody was flying to the country. Nobody was traveling in the country. Nobody, I mean, just was a, it was a very different time. So even when people talk about crime spiking during COVID, crime, all crime did not spike. Subsets of crime did spike, but there were historic drops in crime as well, which have not necessarily lasted, but COVID was just such a weird moment in society. So I worry that people talk about Trump's first term ICE numbers as if Trump was like pro-immigrant in some way. And it was like, no, COVID was so crazy that the whole apparatus was just doing something different. So I say that as like an entry into my news is that ICE, as you know, officers are wearing face masks. So all across the country, ICE officers are covering their face. And what people thought was going to happen was that people would start impersonating officers because you could just put on a face mask, get a gun. And because ICE officers are not legally required to wear uniforms that say that they are ICE, anybody, a group of people could just show up. And you probably have seen the pictures of ICE agents who look like they are like just random people in the neighborhood just showing up, which is a problem. So the news is finally reporting that there is a spike in people impersonating ICE officers. That is dangerous. They're robbing people. You can only imagine how that goes. So I just want to bring that here because that is one of the things that people don't talk about or don't think about. And that is wild to me. But the other thing that I wanted to say that I don't know if either of you knew is that ICE is the only federal law enforcement agency that can do what's called direct hire. So they can actually bypass the competitive hiring process if they say that there is a need for officers, and they can essentially just hire people. So one of the things that the Trump administration is doing is that they are just direct hiring a ton of people. So you probably see this online where people like they're militia members or private agents and da-da. What they're doing is just going through the direct hire process. And because the other agencies don't have direct hire, they have to go through like a real hiring process. But direct hire means that they can just fudge it a little bit. And, you know, I'm happy that people are seeing the horrors of ICE and like what it is looking like in communities. I also just want to say, just as a point of, you know, I feel like I became the Obama defender in this episode, but when people talk about the numbers, the material difference between the Obama deportations and the Trump deportations is that with under Obama, the hierarchy of people that they were focused on were convicted felons. You couldn't even be just convicted of one misdemeanor. You had to be convicted of multiple misdemeanors. And then they actually over-indexed on people at the border. So they turned away a ton of people at the border from entering the United States. They were not doing what is happening now. So Trump, there's actually like a grid that the Obama, there's a memo that the Obama administration put out that shows like tier one, tier two, tier three, but it was almost exclusively convicted, people convicted of felonies, people convicted of multiple misdemeanors, and then people at the border who did not have sort of licenses or paperwork and stuff like that. So under Obama, for instance, like you couldn't be deported for a traffic violation. Like that wasn't a, like, yes, you are not here sort of legally, but a traffic violation doesn't do that. And I won't spare about DACA and all those things that was a pathway to immigration and incomplete and insufficient, but something. And then you get Trump. There are no priorities. You're like, Trump is just going straight into people's graduations and da-da-da. And as you've seen, the numbers are showing that the majority of people that Trump is detaining are not convicted of anything, did not have due process. They are not even, they're being arrested at the immigration hearings. You're like, well, this is sort of a crazy world. So I just, again, I want us to be careful about this idea that like, everybody was the same. Deportations were deportation. And it's like, no, they were materially different. And this moment is materially different. And I don't want that to get lost. And as you can imagine, the Obama administration, the data suggests that they did not use this direct hire process like Trump is using it, as you can imagine. So I'll stop there. But I did want to bring this up.
Yeah. You know, I spend a lot of time in multiracial spaces, multiracial coalitions. And what I will say is that I hear you on the distinctions that you're trying to draw. I'll say that the anxieties that communities experienced didn't feel different from the folks that I know who were trying to think about pathways to citizenship. I don't disagree with you. I'm saying practice and impact are different.
Not the people I'm talking to. So maybe we're just talking to different people.
Yeah. and to your point about like the shortcomings around some of what
you know, previous administrations have tried to do around immigration reform, a lot of the folks that I've talked to are actually really disappointed because Republicans for a long time had been the party of immigration reform, actually. They had been folks who were saying, like, there is a business case for us to figure out a shorter and surer pathway to long-term either, like, residency or citizenship for people. And so the folks that I know who are organizing in red states and purple states, right, are like, the Republicans have backed away from that issue at the state level and at the federal level, and that has been really hard for them. And so if you're watching in places like Texas and Tennessee, where even undocumented students have been able to take advantage of in-state tuition, right? Tennessee was able to hold the line on that. Texas rolled it back. Like, the folks who are in the sort of immigration reform space are feeling like they are losing even their most reliable allies, who in many instances actually had been Republicans. So I just, you know, I think the picture around immigration and immigration reform in this country actually is not as neat as Democrat and Republican. So that is that. On the pretending to be or impersonating, you know, ICE officials, I think a lot in the direct hiring process in particular, I think a lot about the stories my grandparents told me about sheriff's departments in the South in the 1930s and 40s, and how anytime people got really anxious or nervous around what Black people were doing, the most racist people in town would raise their hands and then end up deputized, right? And so this, to me, feels very much akin to that. And I think there are historical parallels and historical lessons that we can learn that might be applicable to this moment about, like, how we show up and how we think about standing in solidarity with and protecting our friends and neighbors who might be targeted. Because I think what we are seeing right now also is just large-scale racial profiling. And so it's like, do you look like you might be undocumented, right? And we also know, like, as we've talked about before, you know, especially I live in Los Angeles, there are large numbers of, like, undocumented Asian immigrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't seem to feel, as communities anyway, don't seem to feel like they're under the same pressure, under the same level of scrutiny. And so, you know, this is not, as we all know, right? This is theater. This is about trying to live into a set of campaign promises that Trump made so that his base feels like he's held the line on something that's important to them. Our immigration system is broken, and I just wish that we had some vision around how to do that that was not so reliant on armed law enforcement and that wasn't so reliant on trying to fix it on the backs of our young people and denying them pathways to opportunity.
The first thing when thinking about these ICE raids, the first thing that comes to me is a rearticulation of what's happening. Because I think in the rearticulation of what's happening, then lies what needs to happen. So the rearticulation is there is an imperialist white nationalist system or group that is called themselves ICE that are deleting usually the pathways in order to empower people to be able to terrorize communities. So the systems you have to go through in order to be an ICE agent are being deleted. So all you really need is the willingness in order to proliferate white nationalism, imperialist terror. So now that we know that that is what's happening, and now that we know that anybody from the good old boys or whatever white nationalist group you can think of to Dr. Phil is going to be a part of it, then I hope that immigrant communities who are brown and immigrant communities that are Black look at the Black Panthers, look at Lincoln Heights today, and say to themselves, so what do we do in order to arm ourselves, in order to protect ourselves, now that we know that there is an organized effort to annihilate the people who are next to me, who may have nothing to do with me, even though, you know, where I live in Ohio, the huge Haitian community, they're all panicked, they're all being terrorized. But what I've been witnessing is people saying, we already know the government is a failure. We've already felt the government is a failure. We feel it every single time we are on our roads and we have those potholes. We see it every single time that somebody asks us to be their president and we see nothing change economically or materially in our lives. And we still see people die in front of our neighborhoods. So we already know that that is a failure. So what are we going to do now that there's a new failure being sprung? How are we going to respond to that? But I think as long as we're kind of like being almost maybe entertained, shocked by the fact that there are white nationalists in a white nationalist nation willing to do white nationalist shit. That's always been the case, you know? And maybe that's because I lived next to, you know, Stone Mountain in Georgia. I saw Ku Klux Klan rallies. The Confederate flag was flying during middle school for me. That was our state flag when I was living in Georgia. I've had white kids come and tell me, call us all types of niggers. I have not in any part of my life agreed with the idea that we are living in this progressive, in this progressive liberal notion. And I think right now people are going to have to catch up to the fact that there's more than a policy change that needs to happen. I'm trying not to be super provocative around being armed or violent or organizing in order to arm yourself. But look at the history books, look at the Black Panther Party. That is what's necessary. Anything else is a slow descent into fascism and a slow descent into authoritarianism in your life. That is the only answer to what you see happening to me, in my opinion, today.
DeRay finna fire both of us after this week. Okay.
No, I will say it's like I'm happy to hear the arguments because I'm like, oh, we got a lot of work to do. That's what I feel after. So I'm like, I need to go reorganize better.
I'm on your side.
Yeah, you might be absolutely right. It's like I think everybody, Sharonda, you, me, I think that we all arrive at the politics and the mental states that best equip us for the lives that we're leading. I never was I don't know anybody. I'm not in neighborhoods where, me visiting Lincoln Heights. I'm trying not to say where I live now or whatever, but I live in another hood. I've only lived in Black hoods. So this is the politic that has helped me survive and be able to talk to you at 34. So I would love to be illuminated and enlightened to another way of doing some things, but I've never seen it work. I've never seen it happen. And the one time I try to get some things going other people, then the hospital almost kills you. Then the food stamps take 6 months to come. Then the welfare gets taken away. So it's like, no, that. I don't want to participate in that anymore. I want something alternative that exists no matter if the party is blue or red.
Yeah. This is where I'm like the right one, the messaging. Is that like what Trump is doing really well is that when you ban all the Black countries from coming in, they don't get logged as deportations, but it's brilliant. It's like a beautiful, it's like reverse deportation that won't show up in the numbers, but you just don't let anybody from the countries come. You're like, that is like a really fascinating way to do something that is just not the same as what other people have done, you know? And I think about this idea that people experience immigration. Say, I'm like, I know people who were able to go to college, or were able to stay, or were able to benefit from things because of the Obama work. That is just true. And the last thing I'll say on this that is actually true of all of the work, not just it's healthcare, it's food stamps. We might survive because of a weird rule. Is that I do think my critique of the organizing left is that I think organizing is always twofold. It is like say the big idea and then convince people of the big idea. Like it is always both of those things. And I think in the last 12 years, I've seen organizers nail saying the big idea and not necessarily convincing people of the big idea. Like they sort of like let go of that work being their work. And I do think that we have to do that better. I don't think that is forget the party. I think that you ask people like, what is the fix for healthcare? It's like, I think nobody knows. I don't think the left has an answer for like, what is the fix? It's like, do people really know what single payer is? Do people know what universal, like it? It's sort of a mess, you know? I think that the question of how we do it is actually, that is the question. Like that is the, you know, like food stamps, for instance, we did it five different ways before we landed on what we do today. And there were legit, you know, the first version of food stamps is we were mailing surplus food to communities and giving it to people. That was a way to deal with the surplus, but Miles would get 10 pounds of apples and Sharonda would get 10 pounds of melons. And you're like, well, yeah, I need food, but like that wasn't the best way to do it, but it was actually direct assistance to communities. So the how is actually not like sort of a frou-frou thing. The how matters a ton. And I think that my critique is of the organizing left is I think that we have to equip people on like the what and the how that makes sense for them. Because, you know, free healthcare for all could mean a doctor's visit a year. That you could operationalize it that way, or it can mean a doctor's visit every time you get sick. Those are two very different ways to build a healthcare system. You know, anyway, blah, blah, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Sharonda, lead us.
The last thing I'll say on that is that I feel like this is, DeRay, what I was saying about you last week, which is like, it's a thing that people don't know about you. And that is your brain comes alive in thinking about how to operationalize solutions to these challenges, right? Like, I think people think of you as just an organizer, but you have a very bureaucratic brain. And I don't know. I think it's a thing that people might not have a ton of visibility and insight into how your brain works. So wanted to mirror that back to you.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This is an ad by BetterHelp. Men today face a lot of pressure to perform, provide, keep it all together, and June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. And I just wanted to talk about that really upfront, because I know a lot of men who just need to talk about the world they're in, need another ear that can listen to them, and that are going through a lot of stuff. And I'll tell you, it is no wonder that 6 million men in the U.S. suffer from depression every year, and it often goes undiagnosed because we have not normalized the idea that it's okay to struggle, and that real strength comes from opening up about what you're carrying and doing something about it so you can be your best for yourself and everybody in your life. I'm telling you, when you feel the weight of the world on you, trying to do that alone is just really hard, and sometimes it becomes just too hard for people. People break, people snap. It doesn't have to be that way. There is someone to talk to out there. And I'll tell you, therapy was that for me. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works with an App Store rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client reviews. And it's convenient too. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button, which helps you fit therapy into your busy life. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two forts of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
My news this week is about a survey or a poll conducted by YouGov and the Young Men's Research Institute. It's a survey of 1,000 young men aged 18 to 29, not just voters. And there are a couple of like really interesting data points that I wanted to bring to the pod for discussion that I think tell us a little bit about the state of just sort of manhood in this country right now and perceptions of it. And then also because we are always talking about the Democratic Party, and I think a lot of people, particularly in sort of more mainstream media, have talked about young men moving away from the Democratic Party as sort of a permanent shift. I think this poll gives us some insight into where and how some of these young men, many again, who are not voters, are persuadable and movable on issues that we care about. So a few data points that I wanted to highlight to talk through. One is this shift with a majority of young men in this age group saying that there is not any career that they admire, which is really fascinating to me, with young Black men in particular saying that entrepreneurship is the most admired career for them if they were to choose one, and that the least appealing career for men across the board, it was public service. So I think there's something telling in there. Across the board, also for most men, the most important aspect of being a man was providing for your family, and that spiked among Black men. But the sort of least important aspect of being a man was helping people who needed. Again, I think an interesting data point there. There are trends, you know, we've been having this conversation about trends towards secularization in the U.S. kind of more broadly. But about 50% of the young men surveyed said that religion remains an important part of their life, with that being much higher among young Black men.
I think an interesting thing for Democrats and the party to think about is that none of the people we are talking about as leading contenders for the next presidential election have significant name recognition among any of the men in this cohort, right? So we have talked a lot about Pete Buttigieg and Wes Moore and others, right? And these young men are like, we don't know them. And so I think that that is important. And I think the Democrats have a lot of work to do if they are thinking about who they're going to bet on this next election. And then the last thing that I want to highlight is sort of stuff around how young men think about the lives they want to live in terms of like partnership and home ownership, et cetera, right? Most of these young men have been or responded that they have been in at least one significant relationship in their lives. So this is not a group of like quote unquote incels, which I think is also a conversation that has really been taking root here. But that also these are young men who say that they really desire a spouse, a family, and to own a home. So still have very traditional notions around the lives they want to build and feel most frustrated that those things feel out of reach for them. And that is across lines of race. So wanted to bring that here because I think we're hearing a lot of narratives take root around this cohort of young people. And I think that what I am seeing in this data is people are looking for connection, they're looking for meaning, they're looking for fulfillment through their careers, and they're looking for pathways to build a stable home life and family. And so I think actually looking at this data gives me a little bit of hope about how we can engage young men and the issues that we need to speak to and thinking about how to best engage them. So wanted to bring that here for discussion.
I found that this article really, really, really interesting. The first thing I wanted to kind of say that I feel like fits right here is that the YouTuber FD Signifier, actually a day ago, to when we're recording this, which is on Sunday, posted a video and he talks about the bombing years in Black people. And I think that that was really enriching. I don't agree with everything FD Signifier says, but I think that was really enriching and complicated. And here is one of the things that I disagree with what he said in another video, not this video, but another video, is around Black men in college is, and really Black men in, I guess this like world, like the thing that really struck me, Sharonda, was when you said there's not any career like that they want. And I resonated with that so deeply. And when I was reading some of those New York Times articles, the New York Times articles about college, I was like, well, how do you have a population of men, right? Specifically, when we're talking about Black men, who less than 100 years ago, being lynched, being totally told you're not allowed in this society. And then doesn't it seem kind of natural that there will be a large population or a group from this population who does not find it easy to mutate their personalities to fit inside of the thing that tried to annihilate them or tried to assimilate? And I think that when I see these answers, I see a failure to create a sovereign Black community within America. I see the failure of there not being these maroon spaces or that maroon politic. Forget having the space, but about having the maroon politic of saying, no matter where you're at, no matter what you go do for work, you still have this community and this place to go down to. And that community, even though there's, I know everybody got an LLC and everybody's talking about communal spaces, a lot of that is fantasy. We're not in a nation that is where their soil is fertile for community. We're just not. And we can have that fantasy and we could talk about it and we can aim towards it, but it's not true. And we see it when we look at certain statistics specifically around Black men, and we see that their rejection to certain things makes a lot of sense. And the reason why I kind of connected with me is because I'm somebody who was not inspired in high school. I'm somebody who didn't have the upwardly mobile trajectory, you know what I mean, of education. And I was totally outcasted by this society and this media and this culture that I just thought was so alien and stupid and white, and I didn't want to participate in it. And to be honest with you, there have been times in my life, thank God for writing and creativity and other things, but there's times in my life that I'm like, yes, I would rather sell drugs or try to be an entrepreneur or do survival sex work than participate in something that feels like a violence to me being in the room. And I know if I feel like that as somebody who can code switch with the best of them, who is wearing a white collar shirt as we speak, I know if I feel like that, there's other Black men who feel like that. And I think that we have to just address our failures in that way. And that's what this article pushed me to even further think about. And I think FD Signifier and so many other, you know, I'm all about the Black YouTube and Instagrammer girls and stuff. I think there's so many people attempting to remedy that, explain that, and also help us get visions of what that looks like in ways that maybe are unique from what we tried before.
Also, before I respond to this, I would ask that for next week, if you can come with a list of YouTubers or videos we should watch, those of us who, the YouTube space is so foreign to me that I don't even know where I would start. I don't know. So I've never heard of FD Signifier. I know you really like Taylor Lorenz, who we actually should just get on the podcast.
She's on YouTube, but she's like a reverse YouTuber, right? Like she already has, she's kind of in that Don Lemon, Joy Reid, even though she's her own independent thing, but she's already had the clout. So I would, yes, I will definitely do that. But I want some people who generated from YouTube and sustained from YouTube and didn't come from Washington Post or, you know, MDC.
Yeah, because I'm like, yeah. You say these names, I'm like, if I type in, I would go to YouTube and be like, political video about now or something. Like, I don't even know what I would type to find the people you talk about. So there are two things that I think are really important that that you should have talked around. The first is, I think that we in the public conversation mistake name recognition for trust.
Yeah.
And this poll does a really good job of being like, Elon has high name recognition.
Below trust.
But almost more than half of the people who know Elon's name don't actually trust him.
Yeah.
So when I see all these articles around like, the left doesn't have the people and the right has like the big podcasters and da-da-da, you know who does have more than 50% trust among this age group is Mr. Beast.
Yeah.
The Rock. You know, like it is, so they do trust some people.
LeBron James.
LeBron James. They do not trust the people that sort of the media suggests are like owning the manosphere and that they listen to them. They know who they are. But like Andrew Tate, all those guys are like, you know, more than 50% like not trusted. So I think that's interesting. The second thing is that I was heartened to see that people like want us our families and da-da-da-da-da. Like it, this idea that young men have sort of like opted out of community or society is, it doesn't seem to be true in the data. I do think, to both of what you have said, I think that they are opting out of a type of way of being in society that's like, you get a job, you work it for 30 years, and you just, like, I think nobody's interested in that. I think that, you know, how people date and fall in love, I think all those things are interesting and different. We have a lot of work to do with feminism. You know, the men are a little, you know, still very transphobic and homophobic, which was, I thought we had worked on that just a tad. It seems like we've not with the, you know, of all the kids, I, you know, I'm like the 18 to 21 year olds, it was okay to be gay in high school. I'm like, it was not for me when I was, you know, when I was, they were wearing fingernail polish. And I'm like, that would have been, I'd had to go to a different school if I wore fingernail polish. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So it does make me hopeful in a way. But I think that the space is wide open. I think that everybody's hungry for leadership was another thing that I saw in this. There wasn't anybody that people are like looking to, and Sharonda, you pointed to this, but we over-index on Bernie, Gavin, and AOC as like voices that people listen to. This cohort barely knows who they are. And, you know, if they know who they are, barely trust them. And I mean, barely in the like 5% range. It's not even, you know, this is a negligible, negligible input. Miles?
I want to offer an idea too when it comes to when I was reading this data, and I think it also makes me think about Elon and like just like the conversation I've been having with, or just with like specifically young people, young dudes, young straight dudes. I don't know specifically when it comes to conservatism and like the wave of conservatism that I've seen, I don't know how much trust is valuable. And I'm not saying it's not valuable, but I feel like a lot of people put your willingness to comply over if I trust you.
Can you say it differently?
I wonder, because I know language is a place of struggle. I know media literacy and illiteracy is a problem in this country. I wonder if we have ideas around what trust means that means one thing, but doesn't really matter when it comes to who you pick to be your leader. I think that what people look for, specifically when you start talking about the right and men, I think people look for people who are willing to comply or obey the kind of, in some ways, like the fascist rule, or when it comes to even Bernie, some people didn't like Hillary for some really astute reasons, but there were some people who did not like Hillary because she wouldn't comply to their particular leftist ideas and won't bend to it. I think they're looking for people who will bend to their will, less people who they trust. So I think that if you were a Democrat who wanted to win the presidency, I don't know how much people need to trust you. I don't trust Gavin Newsom. I don't think anybody's going to trust Gavin Newsom because he reminds you of American Psycho. I think that's his benefit. I think that what people want to witness is that Gavin Newsom is going to do what I told him to do. Because when I vote for you, I'm telling you what to do in certain circumstances, and I expect for you to behave and perform how I voted for you to do.
That makes total sense. If you wrote the poll question, how would you, this doesn't have to be perfect, but I'm interested in this. How would you ask it if like outside of the trust frame? Would you say something like, you know, of the people listed, who do I think is most likely going to do what they say? Or who do I think is going to do what I want? Like, is that what you would ask? Is that versus like of the people, who do you trust the most?
Absolutely. I would ask, I was like, who would do what I want them to say? I would even ask, what does trust mean to you? Give them multiple choices of what trust even means before you ask them a question about trust. Make sure we're working with the same definition. Ask them, do you need to trust somebody in order to be led by them? I think these are all questions mm-hmm. that really see what's really going on with the psyche and what yeah. who you need to produce in order to get those people to vote. So my news today is Tyler Perry. So here it is, y'all. And I think that this conversation...
Okay.
I think because this conversation in all ways is really talking about one thing. And what I really do think is that Black people, Black culture has really fed into this kind of like neoliberal project, both in media. And I think that in a lot of ways, we're witnessing that neoliberal project crumble. And I think that a lot of Black people have emotional relationships with the people who are the tycoons of that project, and also the projects and the music and the films and all the delicious stuff, because it's magical. But this Tyler Perry story, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, Tyler Perry was sued by a young actor named Derek, who accused him of what it reads as some flirtatious text, sexual coercion, and some dialogue that nobody, I don't care if you work at Arby's, and I don't care if you work in the biggest bank in the world, nobody's boss text you the things that Tyler Perry was texting this man. I guess what I really want my news to be about, rather than just the scandal, is the very clear matrix of power and influence and persuasion that Tyler Perry employed in order to control this scandal. So I was watching Taraji P. Henson speak, Sherry Shepherd speak, because they're in his latest movie, Straw, and they talk about Tyler Perry and how great he is and how many millionaires he's made and how great he is. And I thought, they're laying it on kind of thick. It felt like something was coming for Tyler Perry, and then lo and behold, this case drops. And then when we look at this case and him talking to this very attractive white boy and giving him money, not because he's good at his job, but because Tyler Perry wants to lay down with him, that is the same thing that Christian Keys, never names Tyler Perry, just says it's a very distinct Black billionaire who everybody loves, who makes movies. We only got one of them, but who also might be a little fruity, but he never names Tyler Perry. But that's the same thing that Christian Keys accuses of Tyler Perry doing. And then when we look at our own satire, our own kind of left of center satire with its failures, I'm talking about Boondocks. So when we look at the episode of Boondocks critiquing Tyler Perry, they describe the exact thing that he's accused of. And my thing is, when I look at these Shade Room comments, when I look at the Hollywood Unlocked comments, I see bots. And I also see a lot of Black people who are so attached to Black excellence, even if it's not happening via their lives, that they will not look at things that are very clear and very obvious. That a Black drag queen with church trauma who got beat up and who got sexually abused can do the same thing to somebody else. It is simple math. He's never been to therapy. Like, allegedly, he did it to me, allegedly, in my opinion, it's obvious. And what gets me scared is if Black people are so fascinated and so attached to the people who have power and who have fame and who are symbols of this kind of Black excellence that we adore, that we're never actually able to critique power and create something that, again, the word sovereign comes to mind, and also has some type of moral compass upwards. If at any moment we say, well, we already did enough. We gave them enough. Predators are not chess pieces. That is not how we do things. That is not how we should do things. So just because they got Harvey, we don't, now we give them Bill, or, oh, they got whoever, Johnny Depp, so we need to get Diddy. That's not how this works. If there's anybody who is going to prey on Black folks who are poor and vulnerable with money, with fame, and with the promise to take them out of poverty, if that person is willing to do whatever they have to do, I don't care if you are raping people. I don't care if you are sending them text messages that let them know that your financial destiny lies in if you will lay down with me or flirt with me back. That is financial exploitation. And if you're talking about the poorest population in this nation being producing those people, and for it to be weaponized for people inside of our race, outside of our race, that is something to critique and to disavow. That is something to say, I don't care how many times I watch Medea's Family Reunion, and I love that Cicely Tyson, and I love that Maya Angelou, and every single time I'm on land, I say this land, and I will continue to watch Medea, but I'm able to say both things at one time. And I think that we have to stop just seeing, we just have to be okay with Black people going through a lot, just being less than 100 years out of segregation and going into this white media apparatus that birthed minstrelsy and us having huge failures. And one of the huge failures that we created a minstrel drag queen who finds it okay to sexually and financially exploit other people, allegedly, because they have church trauma, allegedly. And I think that is the thing that people don't want to talk about. I think that people know that this happened and they don't want to talk about it. Now tell me how you disagree, y'all.
Here's what I will say. You know, for all the listeners, we don't talk about the news until we get to the podcast. So I never really know what people are going to say. So I'm processing in real time. I was surprised at the comments online that were so ardently pro-Tyler. Like, I was sort of, like, surprised by them. And I talked to somebody about it last night, and they were like, well, the $200 million lawsuit is silly. And, like, they were like, the number makes it not serious. And I'm sort of like, well, I am a manager of people, and I've been a manager of people since my early 20s. I couldn't imagine as a manager sending texts like that. As an employee, I couldn't imagine receiving texts like that. So, like, just mm-hmm. independent of, like, Tyler the person, independent of race, independent of his job, just like the manager-employee relationship, I just couldn't imagine sending or receiving those. I've had to discipline people who have sent less text than that.
Yeah.
And still, you're like, well, that just is inappropriate. And given the level of power you hold, you just can't be in the role. You know, like, I don't want you to die. I don't want you to not be able to eat dinner. But you just can't be in this role in that way. So I was actually surprised to see people just sort of like blindly defend Tyler, like not interrogate, not sort of say, hold these two things true that are like, hey, you know, great films, interesting films, and like not a great manager or like inappropriate manager or sexually harassing people manager. So you're right. The tour that sort of defense of Tyler, I do think it's a precarious situation. What does it mean when there are so many Black actors who are like, Tyler is the only person who ever paid me a real wage? And the loyalty that engenders both amongst those actors and all of the people who like those actors, that is something. And I always say about Tyler, for Tyrae's birthday, when she was, 16, 17, we went to go see Tyler Perry in a high school auditorium. And it was like the second coming of, it was like the most live play I'd ever seen in my life. I think it was the first play I'd seen live. So I'll be interested to see how this plays out, but I was surprised at people's sort of wholesale defense of Tyler. That was surprising to me.
So What your response made me think of is how obviously not surprised I am because I saw the Bill Cosby stuff and I saw the R. Kelly stuff and how people reacted, but I also saw the Jussie Smollett stuff. And I also saw people know that Jussie Smollett, no, come on. I saw people know what Jussie Smollett did, saw the evidence, saw the documentaries, saw what was going on. And instead of saying, I'm not a carceral logic person, so I know that this person did this because I'm not going to reject my own logic to my own intuition in order to sustain your fantasy and sustain your lie. But I will say I've made mistakes and I stand beside you as you made your mistake. And I say that there is no black person for a nonviolent crime who should be put in prison. We didn't see that though. We saw a whole bunch of people gaslighting a whole bunch of other people. So if we have even the most progressive and the most intellectual of people playing that gaslighting game, then of course the people who got two jobs and who are doing DoorDash on the side, who love Tyler Perry, are going to play that game too. Who's setting the standard?
Who's setting the standard? That's a good book.
The only thing I would add is I think, you know, to DeRay's point about this being like, unfortunately, a pretty common experience in workplaces is I think we explain away when this happens in so many other workplaces, particularly if this happens and it like results in like a marriage or whatever. And you're like, wait a minute, hold on a second. You were her direct manager and now you're her husband? You know? And I think that for a long time, people were like, well, it's okay if everyone involved is like consenting. And I actually don't believe that. I think when there's a power imbalance like that, that you should not pursue a romantic relationship with someone. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, our public conversations around consent are really new. And I think there are also people in the same way that we saw with Cassie, et cetera, right, where they're like, if you were going to be this proximate to a rich, powerful man, you should expect that this is the cost of being that proximate to them. And we also haven't uprooted that thinking that is like deeply, deeply seated in so many of us. So, yeah. So last week when we were talking about the political assassinations in Minnesota, we talked about Melissa Hortman. I said that my understanding at the time was that she was no longer in the state legislature. That was actually not correct. She was no longer the speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives. So she was still in the legislature. She just was not in that same leadership position because of the result of an election that resulted in a tie between the two parties. So I wanted to issue that correction since that came up and was discussed in the comments during last week's episode.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
This week, I sat down with scholar and president of the ACLU board, Deborah Archer, to talk about her new book, Dividing Lines, How Transportation Infrastructure Reinforces Racial Inequality. Her book is the essential account of how transportation infrastructure from highways, roads, sidewalks, y'all, sidewalks, and buses became a means of protecting segregation and inequality after the fall of Jim Crow. Let me tell you, I thought I understood this. I thought I understood people talking about transportation, infrastructure, and racism. I did not understand it until I talked to Deborah Archer. You have to listen to this. You have to go buy the book. Here we go. The one and only Deborah Archer, it is an honor to have you here on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
Now, our work has intersected a lot, both from your role as the board chair of the ACLU, but also because of your scholarship on housing ordinances, which our team at Campaign Zero came across. And then your newest book, Dividing Lines, literally blew my mind. So let's just start with how you got to civil rights. Did you always know you wanted to do civil rights law? Did you want to be a professor? Like, how'd you get here?
I think my parents would tell you that I've always wanted to be a civil rights lawyer. They tell me that as early as they can remember, I talked about doing the work that I'm doing now. I think that I got into civil rights because I wanted to fight for families like mine and people like me and our ability to live without discrimination, our ability to live with dignity and respect. I come from a background, I think most people wouldn't think my parents are Jamaican immigrants. I'm the first generation American citizen in my family, the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I grew up in Connecticut, one of the richest states in the country, but deep poverty, deep inequality, deep segregation. And my parents often had to struggle to provide for us to navigate around the discrimination they faced because they were immigrants, because they spoke with an accent, because they're Black, because they didn't have financial resources. And it really did motivate me to do the kind of work that I'm really blessed to be able to do today.
Now, you know, I have seen a lot of stories about the racist history of the highways, or I've seen people talk about that. But what you do in the book is you zoom us beyond highways, not just highways. So there's a lot of talk about highways here, but I had no clue about sidewalks. I didn't know people were putting barricades up on the streets. I'm like, what is going on? This is so wild.
Yes.
Before we jump into those details, how did you get to transportation? Like, did you... You know, you've written about a lot of things in civil rights. Did you know that you were going to focus on transportation? Did you stumble across the transportation history? How'd you get here?
Yeah, I didn't know that I would end up here. I've been a civil rights and racial justice attorney for almost 30 years. And during most of that time, I did not think about transportation justice as a civil rights issue, although I really should have. As you mentioned, a lot of my work is at the intersection of race and place and exploring the inequality there. And I found that we aren't really having full and robust discussions about what brings us to inequality when we look at place and space and housing. But the way that I got to transportation was that I was invited by a community group in New York to work with them to defend and represent a Black community that was anticipating a infrastructure project. And they wanted to make sure that racial justice and racial equality was centered in the conversation. This community had been harmed decades before when a highway was built right through the community. And now they had, you know, spent decades rebuilding their lives in the shadow of that highway and didn't want to the new infrastructure project to repeat those sins of the past. And through the work with that community and the organizers there, I came to learn how widespread this story was, that basically every state in the country, you can find a community of color that was destroyed or siloed or being blocked off, isolated by an infrastructure project. And I just began to dig and dig, spending more time with communities to hear their stories and to really try to understand the ongoing impact.
Now, there were so many things I didn't know. First of which was the history of the Birmingham bombings. You focus on a period of time where there were 50 bombings. And I had no clue that they were in response to the racial zoning laws. Can you talk to us about that history and why it was important that you foregrounded that in the book?
When I started to do the research for this book, I also knew general history in the way that you say that you've known it. We know all of the awful things that have happened and been done to Black people and Black communities in order to hold on to and protect white supremacy. But I also didn't realize that so many of those things were directly tied to advances in housing and migration of Black folks out of Black communities post Jim Crow. So in Birmingham, Alabama, as Black people started to feel the weight of the civil rights movement and feel empowered and were able financially to move into areas that were formerly zoned for whites only, because Birmingham used racial zoning laws, which literally said on this side of the street, white people can live, and on the other side of the street is where Black people can live. But Black people were starting to move and violate those invisible lines that were created by laws. And the attorney who represented a lot of those families saw that his family was terrorized, his house was bombed, churches were bombed, and Birmingham, Alabama came to be known as Bombingham because of all that was going on. And Birmingham is a really powerful example. After the racial zoning laws were struck down, Birmingham built I-59 and I-65 to maintain the racial segregation. In some places, the highway follows the exact lines that the racial zoning laws used to follow. But Birmingham isn't alone. We can talk about Atlanta that also built, you know, you said literal walls blocked off a street. Atlanta had what was called the Atlanta-Berlin Wall, and that was built in 1962 after a black surgeon bought a house in a white neighborhood, and white folks in the neighboring community wanted to protect their community from more black folks coming in, and they built a barricade in the middle of the road. And that barricade stood there for about 72 days before it was taken down. But it really kind of opened up the opportunity to continue to do that and similar things all throughout Atlanta.
You know, what really struck me about the way you set up the conversation with the highways is that precisely what you said, I knew that it had happened. I didn't know that it was a way to circumvent other things being deemed unconstitutional or like other ways of doing zoning. I had no clue. Before we talk about the barricades in the streets and the sidewalk, which I thought was just wild, I was actually like really, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but you actually were able to find that they wrote about the explicit intent around the highways. This wasn't even like, you know, you're not like guessing about their intent. They wrote it. So that was one I wanted to talk to you about. The second is that I hadn't even considered until I read the book about what happens when you use eminent domain and don't pay black people for their homes, or you pay people dramatically under market value as a way to continue to screw them. And then the third thing that you made me think about, I was like, I never even thought about like the creation of the suburbs. I'm like, oh, I guess you're right. If you make the highways and you disconnect communities, then you make another community and all the white people move to that. I was like, this is how you make the suburbs.
That's right. So there's so much that you said that I want to follow up on. One, the connection between Jim Crow falling and highways being built. Because I don't think that people really understand that connection. And one of the kind of the nefarious genius in using highways and infrastructure as a barrier is that it could withstand evolutions in civil rights laws. As we anticipated the fall of segregation, a highway would stand. So as judicial decisions in the 1950s and 1960s made it more difficult for government to isolate black communities using zoning laws and other regulations, we saw urban planners turn to highways. And it really kicked into high gear when the court signaled the fall of segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, which I'm sure everyone knows was decided in 1954. And in the wake of Brown, government officials proclaimed and demonstrated through real extreme measures that they were going to protect segregation with everything that they had. And so 2 years after that decision, we found Congress had hearings on the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 and then passed that act. And so they switched from redlining and racial zoning laws to the highways. And after that happened, government officials didn't hide their resegregationist attempts. They were pretty explicit, saying, we're going to build the highway here because that's where the racial zoning laws had the dividing line. In Atlanta, the mayor saying, I have to build the highway I-20 right here on this route because I promised the white community that I would give something to them to protect them. And so they didn't hide it. And so I was able to find many examples where communities were explicit about needing the highways or roads built in a certain way to protect them from Black people, but also government officials being very explicit to say that they were doing this to protect white people from Black migration.
The suburbs existed when I was a kid. They just were there. And then I was reading this and I was like, oh, I guess they weren't always just there.
No. And so, you know, when to build the highways, they used eminent domain. To build major roadways, they also have used eminent domain And that's a tool that you use to take private property for public purpose. Theoretically, you're supposed to give the owner just compensation, but the compensation was never just. And so for a variety of reasons, Black people did not get the full value of their homes, or they got nothing for their homes. And then they were forced to find new housing in already deeply segregated and overcrowded communities because of racial segregation. So although the highways helped connect these newly emerging suburbs to the city so folks could have work in the city, go home to the suburbs, those suburbs were not open to Black people. They were racially restricted covenants were attached to that housing. There was just rampant housing segregation and discrimination. In the book, I tell the story of a family in Ohio who lost their home to a highway. And every weekend, the family would go to look for new housing. And the son would say that he could see the look on his father's face, the look of disappointment every time they went up to a house. And when the owner realized that they were Black, told his father to go away, that they weren't going to rent to them or sell to them. And so it helped solidify racially segregated suburbs and inner city neighborhoods that grew increasingly segregated, concentrating economic inequality and really overcrowding and taxing of the infrastructure there.
Let's go to page 79. I'm going to ask you to read the bottom of 79 instead of paraphrasing it, because you just wrote it so great that I was like, people should just hear what you wrote. That's why you wrote a book. And I'll tell you, as somebody who wrote a book, I always was annoyed that I would be interviewed and the people didn't read the book. I'm like, this is why I wrote it.
I appreciate that.
The bottom of 79 that starts with the subtle. I'll leave it to you.
The subtle and not so subtle uses of street planning techniques included dead-ending streets, converting roads to one-way streets that repeatedly led drivers away from white communities, turning through streets into cul-de-sacs, changing the names of the streets as they passed from white to Black communities, and refraining from paving streets as they approached racial boundaries. Sometimes municipalities use subtle tactics to limit Black access. At other times, localities made no attempt to disguise the segregationist intent behind nominally race-neutral practices.
Deborah, it literally blew my mind. I was like the highways I'd heard about, you built it out, and I understood the whole shebang by the time I finished reading. Street planning? I was a zero. I had never heard of that before. How did you, how? Tell us, like, or what? Oh, I don't even know what to ask you.
It is mind blowing. It makes you see the built environment in an entirely different way. So it was not just about using the highways to lock in communities, to segregate communities. It was really a belt and suspenders kind of approach. It was that you could not live near us, and we wanted to make sure that it was as difficult as possible for you to get from your house to my house. And we want to make sure that we don't have to suffer any shame by being perceived to live in the same neighborhood or community as you are. And Atlanta, which at the time called themselves the city too busy to hate, really was an example of using everything. They layered everything. And as a result, it's hard to get around Atlanta. So Atlanta changed street names. If you look at Atlanta now, look at a map, as some streets move from across Ponce de Leon, it's one name before Ponce de Leon and a different name afterwards. And that was because Ponce de Leon was a dividing line between Black and white communities. Atlanta has so many one-way streets that just keep leading you away from the Black community, and you cannot easily move from the Black community to the white community because of all the one-way streets just keep taking you around and round in a circle. And then I talk about Memphis, which also used that as well. They had a case that I studied in law school called Memphis versus Green, so I was aware of this example, where they blocked off a road right at the point where the road led from the Black community to the white community. They just built a barrier. They said it was to keep out undesirable influences, But it really was to make sure that Black people couldn't come through their community, couldn't drive through their community, couldn't walk through their community. And it really not only makes it difficult for you to navigate, to makes it hard for you to live your life, to get to where you have to go, to get to the doctor, to the dentist, to buy groceries. It stamps the Black community with stigma, making it seem as if you're so awful that we can't even have you be close to us. We can't even let you get anywhere near our homes and our community. And so it was a lot. It is a lot to process, especially the way that all of this is layered on top of each other, and the really powerful symbolic messages that these kinds of efforts sends to you.
So you already talked about the Atlanta's Berlin Wall and how it was up. It wasn't up forever. It got taken down. It got burned, all those things. But after I read that part, I had to Google because I was like, I've never heard of this. So I'm Googling like, who is this mayor? And I look up the mayor and he's one of the good guys. And I'm like, well, goodness, if the good guy, you know, at first I'm like, this is Bull Connor's cousin and he just hated Black people. I'm like, he won against the segregationist. He was the good guy who still put up a wall because the Black man bought land. That is, you know, if the good guys are doing this, we're down bad.
And good guys are still doing it today, right? It is their choices that we have to make when we're building infrastructure projects. And the choices are always done in a way where Black communities are forced to bear the brunt of the inconvenience of the infrastructure, and other communities get to enjoy the benefits. It's a lot of pressure from powerful, influential, suburban, wealthy communities on our elected officials to do what protects their community at the expense of other communities. So this is not a story about just good guys versus bad guys. I think that's, unfortunately, so often how we think about racism, that we're looking for to identify the bad actor. We're looking to identify the Bull Connors, or we're looking to identify, you know, the racist. But racism isn't all about the Bull Connors. It wasn't then, it isn't today. It operates in various ways. And taking a look at the highways and our transportation infrastructure writ large in the way that I did, I think really helps illuminate the power and creativity and adaptation of racism.
I received that push. Yes. I did Google him because I was like, yes. I've never heard of this before.
It is fascinating, his backstory, and that he was someone who was seen as the more progressive of the choices for mayor in the election just preceding it.
Can you also talk about the sidewalks? This was another part that, you know, you draw a nod to it in the introduction. So I'm like, okay, let's see what's going on with the sidewalks. And then I get to the sidewalks in the second half of the book. And I'm just, again, blown away. Just, you know, I've never heard of this. What I know in policing is that there are some places where it is legal to ride bikes on the sidewalk. And I know that from my work as an activist, but I had never imagined that it would be illegal for Black people to walk on sidewalks until I read your book.
Yeah. So I think sidewalks are really a secondary concern for a lot of people. When I talked about transportation infrastructure, said I was doing this book about transportation infrastructure, no one ever really thinks about walking, and pedestrian infrastructure is part of that story. But really, to this day, there is a legacy of Jim Crow that is felt in neighborhoods across the country because they lack pedestrian infrastructure. After city planners destroyed Black communities with highways and the roadways that we've talked about, they largely ignored not only public transportation, but the needs of pedestrians. And so we didn't think about how are these residents going to navigate the areas around the highways and the overpasses and the access roads without a comprehensive system of well-maintained sidewalks. And so you'll see Black communities that don't have well-maintained sidewalks. The sidewalks lack connectivity, or they're impossible to walk on. And rather than address this inequality and face the problem head on, we do what we have done in so many other ways. Many local governments then responded to their own underinvestment in sidewalks with over-enforcement and over-policing of pedestrian traffic rules. So we have neighborhoods bisected by these highways and roadways. Black residents don't have many ways to move around safely. Residents then can face the threat of systems that target, harass, and arrest them as they try to navigate their own community because they're walking in the street instead of on the sidewalk. Because we have laws that say you can't walk in the street, but we have sidewalks that aren't walkable. And I know people know the very well-known example and tragic example of Michael Brown in Ferguson, who was killed when he was stopped for walking in the street in a community that activists had long said didn't have walkable sidewalks. And activists for a long time, they were fighting for better pedestrian infrastructure for people to more safely navigate their community. And of course, there's always a historical story. And I try to tell the historical aspect of this as well, because sidewalks have always been contested public spaces that were shared by necessity. And as a result, it created daily opportunities to reinforce racial hierarchy and insult and subjugate Black people. So I learned that there was an official term to what I had been doing and experiencing for decades. And it is called giving whites the wall or the white man's right of way. And that's Black people stepping out of the way to make sure that white people could walk on the inside of the sidewalk, farther from the road, and safer for them. And that was called the white man's right of way. It's something that I experience walking every day in Greenwich Village, but I was interested to learn this history, this connection to Jim Crow.
Now, I have to imagine that most of the listeners, including like me, this will be a new way of thinking about transportation for them. Do you have any advice or like, how should people in communities start to think, or questions that people should ask, or is there somewhere people should go? Like, to think about how to make the transportation infrastructure more equitable, one of the things that you do both throughout, but at the end as well, is the limitations of the legal process that people have tried to use the courts to enforce a whole host of things. And, you know, largely cities have been creative about how to screw Black people over. So trying to think about, is there any advice to people on the front end that they could do to be more involved?
Yeah. So just to pick up first on your point about the law, we have lots of civil rights laws that are powerful in many ways and have really beautiful language, but they're limited in transportation infrastructure because they apply after decisions have been made and kind of momentum is behind the decision. They focus on intent and ignore systemic inequality. And as we were discussing, that's not necessarily how racism reveals itself in transportation infrastructure. And they put the burden on the plaintiff and give real undue deference to public officials, basically accepting any excuse that they give for why the only possible route for this road is through a Black community. And so I think the book is trying to call on us to think differently and explore the trade-offs that policymakers have to engage in and not make the same trade-offs always, trade-offs at the expense of Black communities. I think it going forward, it requires a shift in national transportation policy. This includes reimagining how we use transportation and infrastructure to serve and support communities of color. And whether you call it community equity focused or anti-racist design, equitable design, or something else, it's about not looking at our current situation as a neutral baseline. It's about connecting seemingly isolated incidents and projects to common policies and approaches, and recognizing that those approaches keep leading us to inequitable, discriminatory, or oppressive outcomes. And I think we have to find a way to get involved from the beginning. I often hear from communities who want assistance, and I do work with a lot of communities around the country, who are fighting these kinds of projects, but they come to me 5, 6, 7 years after the initial announcement or initial siting decision. And that really is too late in a process to affect meaningful change because of the limits of our civil rights laws. Communities need to be involved, engaged from the beginning. And some of the onus in that is on communities to, when you hear talk of an infrastructure project, a road, a highway, sidewalks, public transportation decisions, to get involved immediately, to seek support, seek resources that will enable you to fight for what your community needs and what your community deserves. But the onus is also on those who are engaged in making these infrastructure decisions to find ways to put racial equity at the center of all of their decisions, and to have really meaningful community participation in decision-making, not just hear their voices after you've decided what you want to do, but empower the community, give them the tools that they need, the opportunities and resources to be meaningfully engaged in the discussion and to be meaningfully engaged in the decision-making.
One of the other things that stuck out to me was how permanent the changes become. So when you write about New York City and you write about Lincoln Center disrupting a community of color, I never knew that until this book, you know? And there's something that happens where what happens when you put this infrastructure over whole neighborhoods is like, we never know. How would I know?
Because these stories aren't being told. But Lincoln Center and the story of Lincoln Center and really everything in the book about infrastructure is part of the legacy, I think, of Robert Moses, who was responsible for building a lot of the infrastructure and parks and cultural institutions in New York and had this philosophy that these infrastructures should go right through Black communities that and other communities of color that he felt were blighted and were a drain on the larger community, and then spread that philosophy, spread his gospel around the country. And so we see that again and again. And I think it's unfortunate that we don't tell the full history of how these beautiful, amazing institutions were built. Lincoln Center is such an amazing community institution, but we should know that it damaged and destroyed Black and brown communities. And transportation is really a paradox. We often think of roads and highways and public transit only as symbols of progress and connection. But I try to tell the story about how these same systems have been used as tools of exclusion and displacement, especially in Black communities. And I think it's important because if you don't understand the truth and full scope of how we got to where we were, we can never actually craft policies and solutions and approaches that are going to get to the heart of the problem. You know, if you want to get at policies, solutions, and approaches that are going to get to the heart of the problem, it has to be based on a foundation of truth and understanding of what brought us to where we are today. And so we have to tell these stories. It's one of the reasons that the attempts to silence discussions around race and inequality, one of the reasons the attempts to end discussions of Black history, to tell only the positive stories of America, why it's so harmful, because it not only deprives us of knowing those stories and knowing the struggle and understanding how the people before us fought to get us to where we are, but also deprives us of understanding the facts of how we got to where we are so that we know how we need to craft our struggles moving forward.
Where do people go to stay up to date on what you're doing or thinking or putting out in the world? Is there Facebook? Are you on TikTok? Is it Instagram? What you got?
Yeah, not on TikTok yet, but I am on Instagram and I am on Twitter and Blue Sky at Deborah N. Archer. And I would love for people to check out those pages and come see me give some talks and learn more about the book and my research.
And one of the last questions I want to ask you is that this is a trying time politically for a lot of people, and people's hope is being challenged in moments like this. What advice do you give people whose hope is challenged in moments like this?
I wish I could say that it was easy to wake up every day and choose hope. The times are really challenging, but I still do because I don't think we have any choice. We have to wake up every day and choose to continue this fight because if we don't continue to push forward, we're going to be pushed back. And we can't afford to do that. In this work around transportation infrastructure, it gives me hope that there are people who have lived in these communities for decades and they have never given up hope. And they are fighting every day with love and determination and creativity. And if they can get up every day under the shadows of the highway, knowing the ways in which our country has worked so hard to keep them locked out and left behind. If they can get up each day and fight, then I really don't think any of us has any choice but to join that fight. And then finally, every day I wake up and I really feel blessed to have the opportunity to do this work, to have the opportunity to lead, and to really be reaping the benefits of those who fought and led and just survived before us so that we could be in this space and enjoy the amazing lives and opportunities that we have. And it is a blessing to be alive in this moment, to do this work when there is such important and vital work to do. And I know that you know that because you're getting up every day and you're doing the work. And it really is an honor to be doing the work alongside you and so many others.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothes.
Dan is very busy, clothes only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.